This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And things haven't changed, really. If there are not sufficient hot-headed teens around to throw rocks, historically, well, cops will provide a few. Here's the message: fear dissent. And don't forget to fear. From Truth Out, posted yesterday, an attorney who represented prisoners detained at Guantanamo Bay was found dead last week in what sources said was a suicide. Andy Hart, 38 years old, a federal public defender in Toledo, Ohio, died of a, they say, self-inflicted gunshot wound. Hart left behind a suicide note and a thumb drive believed to contain his case files. It is unknown where Hart died, what the suicide note said, or whether an autopsy was performed, or what has happened to his 11-year-old daughter. Hart's death comes amid escalating chaos that has engulfed Guantanamo over the past 3 months, from a mass hunger strike to military commissions and renewed pressure on the White House to shut down the prison facility. Hart was one of 36 Guantanamo attorneys who signed a letter in March urging Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel to take immediate action to bring about an end to the hunger strike. Because Hart was a federal employee working on sensitive legal issues, the FBI was contacted about his death. It is unknown if the agency has been investigating the circumstances surrounding his death. More on FBI investigations. Can you hear the quotation marks? In a minute. Neither the FBI nor local law enforcement officials in Toledo, Ohio, returned calls for comments. A phone number listed for Hart was disconnected yesterday. Suicide. Now, here's a bit of news you're not supposed to figure out. Syria has not used chemical weapons. What? Didn't you see the headlines? Syria uses chemical weapons? Syria has not used chemical weapons. Think it out. The Syrian government knows that the use of chemical weapons, chemical arms, is a red line, an excuse for war. I mean, they can read the papers. They can see the TV. And the Americans are saying that there may be, or maybe there definitely is, evidence of small-scale usage derived from, well, we're pretty sure that some of the victims are, you know, they seem like they've been gassed. Well, why should this be so? I'm not saying they haven't been gassed, but why would the Syrian government do this? Why should the Syrians use just a little bit of, say, sarin nerve gas, knowing that it would do little good against their opponents? I mean, heck, they've got MiGs to bomb them with. And knowing that it would bring the U.S. Air Force in against them. Let's see, they've got how many planes the U.S. Air Force has? I think they can probably count, too. Why would nerve gas just taint a few combatants? Now, we're not talking about some yahoos releasing a few ounces of the stuff in the Japanese subways. We're talking about great big bombs intended to wipe out thousands of people. Yeah, drop it from the jet, hit the gas, get the hell out of there, and poof, your opponents are stone dead. It would produce a killing field so vast it could be seen from satellites. Why would the Syrians just sort of leak out a little bit? You know, just here and there. Gonna get you. A little bit of nerve gas. Hope the Americans don't notice. Well, who benefits from that accusation? Who benefits? Robert Fisk writes in Counterpunch via The Independent, quote, "Is there any way of escaping the theater of chemical weapons? First, Israeli military intelligence says that Bashar al-Assad's forces could use chemical weapons. Then Chuck Hagel, U.S. Defense Secretary, pops up in Israel to promise even more firepower for Israel's overarmed military, avoiding any mention of Israel's more than 200 nuclear warheads. And then imbibing all the Israeli intelligence," that word is in quotations in Mr. Fisk's article, "on Syria's use or probable use or possible use of chemical weapons. Then good old Chuck returns to Washington and tells the world that, quote, this is serious business. We need all the facts, end quote. The White House tells Congress that U.S. intelligence agencies, presumably the same as Israeli intelligence agencies, since the two usually waffle in tandem, have, quote, varying degrees of confidence, end quote, in the assessment. But Senator Dianne Feinstein, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, she who managed to defend Israel's action in 1996 after it massacred 105 civilians, mostly children, at Qana in Lebanon, announces of Syria that, quote, it is clear that red lines have been crossed and action must be taken to prevent larger scale use, end quote. Now, I should do a better quote on that. My voice is, I've got a frog in my throat because yesterday I was out there yelling, whose streets are streets? So I'm going to try again. Give that a little bit of a Dianne Feinstein voice. You ready for this experiment? We'll see if I can overcome the frog. It is clear that red lines have been crossed and action must be taken to prevent larger scale use. There. I knew I could do it. And the oldest of current White House cliches hitherto used on Iran's possible development of nuclear weapons is then deployed, quote, all options are on the table, end quote. In any normal society, the red lights would now be flashing, especially in the world's newsrooms, but no. We scribes remind the world that Obama said the use of chemical weapons in Syria would be a game changer. He said, at least Americans admit it is a game. And our reports confirm what no one has actually confirmed, chemical arms used. In two Canadian TV studios, this is Robert Fisk's writing, am approached by producers brandishing the same headline. I tell them on air that I shall trash the evidence. And suddenly the story is deleted from both programs. Not because they don't want to use it, they will later, but because they don't want anyone suggesting it might be a load of old cobblers. More on that at counterpunch.org. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, community radio. Radio with community. Years ago, in 2008, I broadcast a show attempting to address the memory hole as it applied to the anthrax attacks. Now that mysterious letters of white powder are in the news again, I looked back at that script, and lo and behold, it's still relevant because we're still enthralled to the corporate media. The memory hole, like a bad wound, refuses to close. I think it might be a bit infected. The Ricin scare is a little more than a scare. It is a little more than a scare, but of course, for most U.S. citizens by far, the anthrax was not a threat either. But the ricin, well, at 4% potency and without static weaponization, do you know what I mean by that? At Fort Detrick, they have ways of making a poison or a biological weapon a weapon. It's very advanced. Other countries have not been able to duplicate it. The Iraqis tried at one point, well before the whole weapons of mass destruction thing, to imitate the Americans on this. They had their own strain of anthrax called the Volum strain, which has never appeared here in the United States. And they couldn't weaponize. It was Fort Detrick and their advanced researchers, which actually came out of Japanese biological warfare efforts in World War II. Did you know that? They can make little ricin bombs, and they can make anthrax bombs that have a static charge so that when they're released, well, they just fly all over the place, up your nose. Bad news. But this white powder wasn't like that, and the targets of the ricin would have had to snort or lick the white powder to get sick. Funny thing, though, the white powder had much the same effect on the population as the previous anthrax, namely the desire for the authorities to save us from inscrutable forces. And like the anthrax scare, it turns out it isn't so clear who sent it. That first guy they grabbed? Nothing to do with it. So I'd like you to compare the two scares. I'll just bring something right back out of the memory hole here and remind you of details of the anthrax hysteria. And I invite you to keep this question in mind. Who benefits? Who benefits from scaring the American public? Ricin, by the way, is an old favorite. It's come and gone. Dick Cheney on January 10th, 2003, told an audience in London that the gravity of the threat we face was underscored in recent days when British police arrested suspected terrorists in London and discovered a small quantity of ricin, one of the world's deadliest poisons, end quote. William Bloom wrote in Counterpunch that particular ricin wasn't ricin. Wasn't ricin. There was exactly zero ricin there. And the news that it was nothing at all was held up for 3 years. Let's see, 2003. What happened in 2003? Oh, yeah, the invasion of Iraq went forward on schedule. Weapons of mass destruction. Must stop them. We don't want the next weapon of mass destruction to be a nuclear bomb going off in New York City. Who benefits? Who benefits? Here's a blast from the past. The attempt by, this is something I wrote in 2008, the attempt by the FBI to close the Amerithrax, remember that Amerithrax case, represents some of the worst propaganda and corruption we have to endure as a society. To be sure, there are ongoing horrors, such as the daily disproportionate arrests and seeing in prison chaining of African Americans under the Jim Crow drug war, and the anthrax scare is largely behind us now, although it's still possible to scare the wits out of some people by spilling some flour, pointing to it, calling the cops. We're supposed to believe now that a certain Mr. Ivins was solely responsible for processing American AIM strain anthrax into a static polarized bundle, something done only at the most advanced U.S. production facilities. Amazingly, he did this, we were told, with no other help. We are to disregard the fact that his own colleagues find the accusation fantastic, that he developed an anti-anthrax vaccine after the attacks, and that, despite all of this activity, the FBI could not find one spore of AIM's anthrax, that's our anthrax. Good old American flag waving AIM's anthrax could not be found on his clothing, automobiles, house, office, not anywhere really. He appears to have had some nasty, ultra-conservative views, did Mr. Ivins, about civil liberties and Arabs. Ironic, isn't it? If that were an indicator for terrorist activity, it would implicate a great many people in the U.S. government and armed forces, I think. We are then supposed to forget about the former head at Fort Detrick, Maryland. Back to the Future now. This is me in 2013 saying he's still around, by the way. Lieutenant Colonel Philip Zack. When Zack was in charge of Fort Detrick, 27 ultra-deadly pathogens, supposedly all killed by formaldehyde, went missing from the stocks at Fort Detrick. But that's just a starter. Zack, after all, was gone from the labs in the early 90s, except that he was not gone. This is from 2002 in the Hartford Courant by Jack Dolan and Dave Altimari. Hope they're still kicking. They wrote, lab specimens of anthrax spores, Ebola virus, and other pathogens disappeared from the Army's Biological Warfare Research Facility in the early 1990s. During a turbulent period of labor complaints and recriminations among rival scientists there, documents from an internal Army inquiry show the 1992 inquiry also found evidence that someone was secretly entering a lab late at night to conduct unauthorized research, apparently involving, wait for it, anthrax. A numerical counter on a piece of lab equipment had been rolled back to hide work done by the mystery researcher who left the misspelled labor anthrax on the machine's electronic memory, according to the documents obtained by the Courant. Now, departing from the article, gee, I wonder who could get in there. Could it be the boss of the whole operation? Come in anytime he wanted? Returning to the article, experts disagree on whether the lost specimens pose a danger. An Army spokesman said they do not, because they would have been effectively killed by chemicals in preparation for microscopic study. A prominent molecular biologist said, however, that resilient anthrax spores could possibly be retrieved from a treated specimen. In addition, a scientist who once worked at the Army facility said that because of poor inventory controls, we're talking about anthrax here, poor inventory controls. It is possible that some of the specimens disappeared while still viable, before being treated. Not in dispute is what the incidents say about the disorganization and lack of security in some quarters of the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, known as USAMRID, which is less of a mouthful. At Fort Detrick, Maryland, in the 1990s, Fort Detrick was believed to be the original source of the Ames strain of anthrax used in the mail attacks in 2001, and investigators have questioned people there and at a handful of other government labs and contractors. It is unclear whether Ames strain anthrax was among the strains of anthrax in the 27 sets of specimens reported missing at Fort Detrick after an inventory in 1992. The Army spokesperson, Carrie van der Linden, said that at least some of the lost anthrax was not Ames anthrax, but a former lab technician who worked with some of the anthrax that was later reported missing said all he ever handled was the Ames strain. Departing from the text, because that was the good stuff. And that was the stuff that really worked. Meanwhile, one of the 27 sets of specimens that have been found and is still in the lab, an Army spokesperson said, it may have been in use when the inventory was taken. The fate of the rest, some containing samples no larger than a pencil point, remains unclear. In addition to anthrax and Ebola, The specimens included hantavirus, simian AIDS virus, and two that were labeled unknown, an Army euphemism for classified research whose subject was secret. A former commander at the lab said in an interview that he did not believe any of the missing specimens were ever found. Van der Linden said last week that in addition, well, last week that was, we're talking about years ago, that in addition to the one complete specimen set, some samples from several others were later located, but she could not provide a fuller accounting because of incomplete records regarding the disposal of specimens. Once again, parting from the text, we're talking about stuff that can, well, kill millions. Quote, in January of 2002, it's hard to say how many of those were missing in February of 1991, said Van der Linden, arguing that it's likely some were simply thrown out with the trash. Discoveries of lost specimens and unauthorized research coincided with an Army inquiry into allegations of improper conduct at Fort Detrick's Experimental Pathology Branch in 1992. The inquiry did not substantiate the specific charges of mismanagement by a handful of officers, but a review of hundreds of pages of interview transcripts, signed statements, and internal memos related to the inquiry portrays a climate charged with bitter personal rivalries over credit for research, as well as allegations of sexual and ethnic harassment. The recriminations and unhappiness ultimately became a factor in the departures of at least five frustrated Fort Detrick scientists. In interviews with the Courant, two of the former scientists said that as recently as 1997, when they left, controls at Fort Detrick were so lax, it wouldn't have been hard for anyone with a security clearance for its handful of labs to smuggle out biological specimens. Blast from the past. Trying to block that memory hole. Talking about anthrax by way of talking about ricin. You're listening to Press Watch on KBO Portland, KBO Community Radio, KBO 90.7 Portland. The 27 specimens were reported missing in February 1992 after a new officer, Lieutenant Colonel Michael Langford, took command of what was viewed by Fort Detrick Brass as a dysfunctional pathology lab. Langford, who no longer works at Fort Detrick, said he ordered an inventory after he recognized there was little or no organization and little or no accountability in the lab. Quote, I knew we had to basically tighten up what I thought was a very lax and unorganized system, end quote, he said in an interview last week. Once again, departing from the text, we're talking about stuff that can kill millions of people. Lax and unorganized system. Yeah. White-coated lab scientists. Feel safe? Returning to the text, a factor in Langford's decision to order an inventory was his suspicion never proven that someone in the lab had been tampering with records of specimens to conceal unauthorized research. There's much more to that article, and I would say you could find it here and there, but I'll bet you can't. I found it in my files. It's from the Hartford Courant. I don't know. Maybe you can get it. It'd be kind of fun. Try it. Skipping ahead, scientists aside, This is from a different source, I'm sorry. Let me be more specific. This is from me. Scientists aside received a letter that brought up all that harassment activity in the 1990s. They don't mention it, but it included a toy camel with sex toys stuck to it. This is anti-Arab harassment. Obviously from a person or person who were in that Zach clique. The intention of the letter was to direct official attention and blame Assad. No one's claiming that Ivans wrote the letter, but we're supposed to forget all about Zach and Rippy and the gang. If there were a real investigation of the anthrax attacks, rather than a Geronimo Pratt-style political propaganda effort going down, FBI agents would be all over Zach and Rippy and the gang, rather than offering Ivan's son thousands of dollars in a fancy car if he would agree to denounce his own dad. Okay? Back to the future. Glenn Greenwald, writing in Salon. I'm not back to the future yet. This is still the past. Says in this in part in his third update to an article on Amerithrax, longtime anthrax expert Dr. Merrill Nass uses crystal clear rationality to point out just some of the glaring flaws in what the FBI presented. The fact is that the FBI is plainly unable to place Ivans near Princeton, New Jersey, on either of the two dates in which the letters were sent, and worse, the fact that the FBI included several facts which cut against such a finding, that is, as Dr. Nass points out, by itself an enormous omission. Put up or shut up, this is the most critical evidence in the case. If Ivans cannot be placed in New Jersey on either of those dates, he is not the attacker, or he did not do it alone. Now I have to ask, what is the purpose of all this false closure and the 9/11 scares? I asked a lot of stuff like that. And now really back to the future. An article by Kimberly Kindy, published yesterday, Dateline Tupelo, Missouri, M-I-S-S, is that Mississippi or Missouri? That's Mississippi. Okay, Tupelo. which is in Mississippi, come think of it, after keeping Elvis impersonator Paul Kevin Curtis in jail for a week, interrogating him while he was chained to a chair and turning his house upside down. Federal authorities had no confession of or physical evidence tying him to the rice and lace letters sent to President Obama and other public officials. Investigators already had another man in their sights, and according to an FBI affidavit, were collecting physical evidence against this second suspect. It was beginning to look as if Curtis had been framed. But instead of setting Curtis free, court records show, federal officials sought to keep him in custody. First, 3 days after the arrest, prosecutors asked for a psychiatric evaluation. A request usually made by defense lawyers that could have extended his stay in federal prison by several months and allowed investigators to continue to question him. Then, after a judge denied the request, federal prosecutors filed a motion seeking to postpone the court hearing in which they would be required to reveal the evidence they had against Curtis. That was also turned down. They wanted to keep Mr. Curtis in custody, said Hall Nielsen, a former FBI agent who is Curtis' attorney. Quote, they knew early on he wasn't the right guy, but they fought to hold on to him anyway, end quote. The FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Oxford, Mississippi, did not respond to requests for interviews or to written questions. Isn't that interesting? You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO. Tomorrow you can join Head, Heart, Hand, Spirit, members of Code Pink Portland and members of Portland Wilf, to protest drones. That's tomorrow from noon to 2 p.m. in Portland's Pioneer Courthouse Square. Educate and activate, they write, against unlawful drone deaths. Meet on the east side of Pioneer Square, southwest 6th of the milepost marker, midway north and south between Southwest Morrison and Yamhill Street. It's from Code Pink. Time is 9:25 Pacific time. Op-ed news from 2008, reading a New York Times article which had some interesting facts that other mainstream media sources didn't. This from Scott Creighton. Guess what? The two-page story, as I was reading it, says Scott Creighton, when I went from page one to page two, refreshed page one because that is all that was there. They reposted the story without the oddities that the other mainstream media didn't have. They shortened the story to one page by taking out some key information that they had originally posted with the story. I knew I should have copied and pasted it, Creighton writes. If anyone still has the original, please let me know, he writes. What they took out was very interesting. They quoted a doctor who worked with the guy who was being accused, that's Ivans, of the anthrax attacks, as saying that he didn't think the guy did it. They took that part out. They also took out the part where this guy received the highest Pentagon award a civilian can get for his research into an anthrax vaccine to be given to our troops in 2003. They took that out. And they also took out the part where this guy was cited for testing areas outside the restricted area for anthrax spores. And he found them in someone's secretary's desk and keyboard. Remember how this stuff was found on the mail from the Dropbox? It bleeds through the envelope. So when he found it in someone's secretary's desk and then on her keyboard, that might be a good place to start looking for the culprit. But they took that part out. And departing from the text when it says they took that part out, we're talking about the New York Times. All the news that fits. Returning to that Blast from the Past article from 2008, but they did add one thing. The reason I was reading the story again was that was because I was am working on a story about the one thing they missed, motive. The guy, meaning Ivans, now dead, had no motive, and the original story lacked any mention of a motive. Nowhere in the first story and many other mainstream media versions of this, do they mention a possible motive? Nowhere. Well, it seems whoever's checking up on the official stories out there caught that little tidbit as well. And now they've added one. Online now, in the story that was not in the original in the New York Times, quote, authorities were investigating whether Ivans released the anthrax as a way to test his vaccine, officials said, end quote. There we have it, the official story complete with motive from the ghostly unnamed. Who the heck were they, officials? Because that is what they said. Problem with that, it makes no sense. How could he test the vaccine that he hadn't given to those people? He didn't send a vaccine to the reporter in Florida. He didn't give it to those senators. It's ridiculous, moronic, pathetic, thought police, ministry of truth propaganda. It is offensively stupid, and there is, for all to see, some poor writer's name on it. After he produced a good piece of journalism on the very important subject of who used anthrax against our press and our legislature. And this is what happens when the Ministry of Truth gets a hold of his story. They chop it up, censor it, and put it out there for the mainstream media pundits to regurgitate for the masses. That's it. Case closed. The guy who killed himself did it. And there will be no further investigation into the matter. You will accept this, write this and only this, and you will not investigate further than what the officials tell you. And I challenge you, departing from that article, ask a few people What happened with that anthrax? Oh, yeah, there was that scientist dude, wasn't there? Yeah, oh, yeah, scientist dude did it, and he killed himself. Who benefits? Stay tuned to KBOO, Portland KBOO Community Radio, because here on KBOO, you can hear news you can't hear anywhere else. You can hear the news you're not supposed to know. And I'll be back next week, I do hope.
Station Navigators Report, April 30th, 2013. Some of you have heard me talk about the need for change at KBOO and why we find ourselves at this crossroads. You may have also heard some of the actions underway to set KBOO on a course towards long-term stability and sustainability. Change is hard, filled with emotion, and requires doing things that are challenging and difficult. But the potential for KBOO to better fulfill our mission and support the evolving needs of our diverse neighborhoods is within our reach. The KBOO Foundation Board of Directors has called a meeting to discuss the current changes at KBOO, provide historic context for the problems we are facing, and provide details of how I, the station navigator, intend to maximize financial resources, build needed infrastructure, and create the foundation for future stability and growth. If you care about KBOO and are interested in hearing details of the plans underway, straight from the horse's mouth, you are invited to attend this conversational meeting. There will be ample time for questions and answers. It takes place Saturday, May 4th, 1 to 4 p.m., Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. Thanks, and I hope to see you there.
Hi, this is Per Fogring, host of Fight the Empire, and my guest today is Michael Clare, who's a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, and he's a regular on the Tom Dispatch website, and his latest book is The Race for What's Left, and he also has an article out right now on the Tom Dispatch called The Coming Global Explosion. So welcome, Michael Clare. Welcome to KBOO.
I always enjoy being with you.
Well, tell me, in your article, you talk about two nightmare scenarios, scarce resources and climate change. So why don't we start with that, the scarce resources.
What I talk about is how these two are coming together, fusing together and reinforcing one another. I argue that resource competition and resource scarcity is something that's been with us for a while. Many of your listeners, I'm sure, have heard about peak oil.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. Related themes. But now climate change is coming along, you know, like a diesel train out of control, and it's going to multiply and reinforce all of these other factors, because climate change is going to dry up a lot of the world's croplands in many parts of the world. It's going to flood cities. and flood coastal areas. It's going to destroy a lot of the ingredients for food production around the world. So it's going to make resource scarcity infinitely more severe, and this in turn is going to create global chaos, unrest, and migrations and state collapse unless we move much more swiftly than we are to address these problems.
Well, why don't we talk about, like you said, most people are familiar with peak oil, but a lot of people have the idea that it's just, you know, the oil will be gone, when that's not the case. There'll be plenty of oil in the ground, but it'll be more expensive and more difficult to get. So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm happy to do that. It's something I follow very closely. This is a contested topic, needless to say. The techno-optimists say that with a lot more investment in new mining technology, and if we put aside any concern about the environment whatsoever, that we can indeed extract more oil from the earth. The problem with that argument is that most of the oil fields that we now rely on, the giant oil fields that have produced modern civilization, are running out very swiftly, and there's nothing anybody can do to stop that. We're going to lose 70%, 75% of current oil production in the next 25 years from existing fields. And the new fields that are being developed in the Arctic, offshore, in shale formations, are much more expensive and difficult and hazardous to produce. So it's unclear that this new technology, these new methods of extraction, will ever be able to replace the lost oil that we're going to have from existing fields.
Well, one thing that really, heck, a statistic that blows my mind is that with the first oil field back in Pennsylvania in 1859, they struck oil at 69 feet.
Yeah.
Of course, now they go, you know, miles under the ocean and horizontally and everything else. And then there's the shale, fracking of shale oil, which people seem to think that that's a huge reservoir just waiting to be tapped. But it isn't, is it?
No. People don't understand. They think it's like the oil of the past. You drill into the earth and it comes spurting out. And nothing could be further from the truth. The oil and shale is droplets, molecules of oil trapped in dense rock, and the only way